let's be real. Lawsuits are no fun, but with Paulson and Nace, at least, they are a little easier. With two DC-born partners, Paulson and Nace will fight for you the way only a Washingtonian could. Paulson and Nace handles medical malpractice, wrongful death, and other complex injury cases involving negligence. So if you have been hurt or lost a loved one because of someone else's mistake or negligence, call Paulson and Nace for a no-obligation consultation. Visit www.paulsonandnace.com or call 202-463-1999. Today on CityCast DC, we are talking about the future of Union Station, the future of DC media, and the future, make that the lack of future, of the Foxtrot food chain. I'm here with Washingtonians Andrew Bojan and CityCast's own Julia Caron. Today is Friday, April 26th. I'm Michael Schaefer, and here's what DC is talking about. Hey, Julia.
Hey, Mike.
Hey, Andrew.
Mike, hey.
Awesome to see you guys.
Same to you.
And you.
Before we begin, congratulations to our two Nationals tickets winners, Susan W. and S. Croha. Check your emails and maybe your spam folder. And if you're wondering how you too can win cool things from mugs to Nats tickets, think about becoming members. All you have to do is head to membership.citycast.fm and sign up for as little as $8 a month. You will get ad-free podcast stories, exclusive content, and first dibs on events we plan in the future. Plus, you directly help power the work that we do to bring you the local stuff you love every day. Again, that's membership.citycast.fm. All right, so there was some legal news, and I know that both of you are big eminent domain enthusiasts.
For folks who don't know, like, what is eminent domain if they're not, like, bathed in legalese, you know?
Oh, for the love of God, Julia.
Come on.
I think I have a higher estimate of CityCast listeners than you do, because these people are 100% versed in eminent domain.
I bet they are.
Look, so Union Station, as you may know, a leading local train station, has had like a bunch of sort of an erratic commercial history for the part of the station that is not trains. And people may have noticed in the last couple of years that commercial side has fewer examples of actual commerce. And that's partly because during COVID, not a whole lot of people were using the station. But more importantly, there's a long-term plan to really, and they mean it this time, redevelop the station, change the commerce, and kind of build a whole neighborhood around it. Because right now, even though it's right there, sort of adjacent to the Hill and to H Street and to Union Market, it's very kind of isolated from those areas. Anyway, so there was some litigation. The developer wanted to use eminent domain, that is to say, we can claim ownership and compensate you, the others, for your loss in order to do this. It's taken a couple of years, and now the courts have ruled with them, which means they now really get to work on this endless project of spiffing the place up. What would you guys do with eminent domain power over Union Station?
I don't know, man. I mean, I think part of the charm of Union Station is that the exterior of the building is like big and grand and cool, but the interior kind of doesn't make a ton of sense. But like, my big issue with Union Station is when they announce the platform that you're going to go on for your train, everyone congregates in the hall like morons, and it clogs everyone up, and it's a nightmare. So with eminent domain, I would honestly like build out like a whole waiting section area for like any of that stuff. It just doesn't make sense. I don't understand why we can't just go to the platforms.
I don't understand that either. It's so weird. In other countries, you go to a train station, there's lots of tracks, and you walk to the track where your train's supposed to come, and then if it's there, you can get on it.
Right.
Otherwise, you wait. And in Union Station, they don't let you do that until it's time. And which means they have like replicated the most annoying thing about airports, which is like finding your gate and queuing up there. And that's a thing they could, it seems to me, get rid of. And so you've got this like really grand building, but everyone winds up in these snaking lines in the one like not historic part of the building.
In fact, the trashiest area of the thing, which like I'm assuming because they have a domain, they can just like clear the inside and make it whatever they want if they've got the property.
You know, the history there, like I remember as a kid going to New York or something, and the station was, you know, this grand building, but you couldn't go in most of it. It was derelict. I mean, it's a little like Penn Station. You know, you go, it's this, historically, this really beautiful building they wrecked it and you wound up just having to go to this like horrible subterranean area. Then like when I was in high school in like the late 80s, they opened it up kind of as a mall. And it was a big deal because it was like the only movie theater and kind of the only mall like shopping on the eastern side of DC. And there was a big food court. But in the long run, malls stopped being where it was at. And that kind of proved derelict too. So now it's like back to the drawing board with another idea. And right now the scheme is, you know, make more of the station about transit, but also knit it into the surrounding area where there will also be goods and services and food and commerce and life.
My question on this is like, when it comes to the eminent domain portion of this, obviously they sued for Union Station, the surrounding blocks and stuff, like how much of that is under the eminent domain too? Because we talked to Jordan Pascal eons ago about like the redevelopment of that entire area. Does that mean that like this group also is the one that builds the condos surrounding Union Station mm-hmm. that bleed into the H Street corridor?
Yes. I mean, the idea is this is a coordinated thing. Actually, I don't know the like the land title, but sure. it's all, so it's not sort of serendipity. I guess it seems also like a good thing to kind of key it more towards place and residents and so on, because over the time since the last time they blew up Union Station, the number of trains has grown a lot. The number of passengers has grown a lot. There didn't used to be these suburban train lines, MARC and VRE. They ain't all that, but they're more than they used to be. The thing is that, like, as we were talking about with the head of Metro, the nature of work has changed, which means the nature of like where you need to go and when you need to go there has also changed. So banking on this being a place like Grand Central Station was, where like the great laboring masses, you know, get disgorged into the city, that seems like a bad bet. Not because people aren't going to want to come, but because we have no idea. And considering that it seems to take 30 years to even get a plant off the ground there, and then it'll last about 30 years, that seems like not a good long-term thinking. Much better to think, hey, let's make this a cool place for people who live nearby and maybe even encourage people to live nearby.
Well, if I could push back on that just a tad, Mike, one of the things I think that you're going to see coming out of this is, you know, there's a new dedicated passenger lane south of Union Station in Alexandria and Arlington where Potomac Yard is, which was a huge reason that it was very difficult to commute to DC using VRE or Amtrak. And that's going to open that up a whole lot. And I think maybe less so than people commuting every day, that's going to open up areas like Richmond as places that are arguably a place you could live and work in DC and come in a couple of times a week without having to worry about the traffic. You know, and if you look at the real estate prices in Richmond, that's really attractive.
That's so interesting, Andrew. How long does it take to get here from there?
By car, I've had it take like 3.5 hours before. Yeah, it's 90 miles. It should be 90 minutes.
So how long does it take on Amtrak?
On Amtrak, it depends on the congestion because they've shared those tracks with CSX for years. And so if there's freight coming through that, you know, those are CSX's tracks. Now they're going to have a dedicated track. So I think that that's going to be a big thing. You know, Amtrak has a lot of money to spend from this bipartisan infrastructure bill. And one of the things they're doing is improving a lot of that kind of service, those kind of lines between places like Richmond and Washington.
So in theory, you could wake up in your affordable home in Richmond, get yourself to the train station in Richmond, and get to DC in how long?
Yeah, less than an hour and a half, because you're just flying up.
Holy moly.
I think that's a big change. There's also, you know, really nice areas of Maryland that if you could change easily to Amtrak, it would be a lot easier. And that is among the plans. You know, they're going to make it a lot easier to change trains across platforms at Union Station.
Jeez, all this time I thought we would never have to see a Sparrow there again. But if all these people are commuting, it's Sparrow City, man.
It will be Sparrow City.
Yeah, we're all going to need, we're going to need a couple of Sparrows in that mall.
Pizza for all. Pizza for all.
It's time to get dressed up, DC. So Others Might Eat is having its Young Professionals Network Spring Soiree. That's to help raise funds for homelessness in DC. The gala is on the evening of May 17th at the National Museum of Women in the Arts. There will be live music from DJ Heat from the Washington Wizards, photo booths, food, and even a special appearance by a former actor from Pretty Little Liars. Wow. There will also be a canned food drive, so be sure to bring a few cans to support Some's Food Pantry. Grab tickets before they're gone at some.org/springsoiree. That's some.org/springsoiree. See you there.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
All right. Wait, so speaking of things that thrived 100 years or more ago, the Washington media. Andrew, you were the author of the second most viral NPR-related story of last week. You did a long piece in Washingtonian about the closing of DCist, which we did an episode about some time ago. And it was fullest in details about WAMU, and I'd love to hear some of them from you. But I'm more interested in sort of, you know, what is to say about kind of where we're at in media that is specifically about this place that we live, work, and play.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very interesting time for local media here, to say the least. At the height of the pandemic, after DCist and WAMU had merged, they had something like 20 reporters. They have three now. And, you know, before they laid off 16 people, one of them accidentally, apparently, they've lost about 23 people since January 22. So that's really been a big exodus from the station. And so I was just trying to figure out, first of all, why people were leaving and not coming back, and also what led to this sort of bloodbath in February when they laid off all those folks and closed DCist.
So they had all these people. And then was it just that they overextended, spent too much, didn't have the money? Or is this like a change in strategy? They don't want to be like a city council newsroom anymore.
I think that's the question, right? The question is, was this a grand strategic play, which is how they portrayed it? Or was it a matter of cost cutting that was made necessary by a kind of retrenchment in donors and sponsors and sort of a long tail effect of the pandemic that has hit public media, I think, a lot later than it hit commercial media?
So it's a sad thing whenever, you know, I mean, the Post lost a number of people last year, disproportionately in metro coverage. Obviously, those of us who work in media, we are very accustomed to seeing these stories. And the saddest piece of them, because there's always folks like us who will say, like, oh, if only they had done, you know, put a reporter on this beat or covered this subject better or whatever, is I am never clear whether the excellence, or for that matter, the mediocrity of the coverage is related to the financial viability of the platform. In this case, what do you think? I mean, would it have made a difference if it had either been, you know, better, or like they had, you know, apportioned their beats differently in their local coverage or anything like that?
Well, it's hard to say. I mean, because one thing that is knowable in this is that when they were at full strength during a time period, you know, you and I worked together in 2020, it was a crazy time for news. You could find stories pretty much everywhere you went. It is a lot harder now. You know, that's one thing. But the other thing is, you know, it is the number one radio station. And when they were at full strength, DCist was a huge digital brand, reaching at some point more than 3 million people a month. They're kind of a unicorn within the public radio system, the kind of thing that a lot of people were looking at them trying to figure out what WAMU was doing right that they weren't doing.
So what were there things that they were doing right compared to their competitors?
The big thing is reaching young people. You know, public radio's audience via terrestrial radio is getting older and they're listening a lot less. People are listening to like podcasts. Y'all heard of those? Like stuff like that.
Might have made one or two of them.
That's a passing phase.
That's what I thought too. But by getting DCist, they sort of opened this pipeline to, it's not even so much a younger portion of DC. It was a younger segment of DC 10, 15 years ago when the millennials were kind of taking over after Obama came in. What they were successful at doing, DCist, I'm talking about, is kind of building an identity around living in the district, being proud of this. And it was very district focused, which, you know, was not WAMU's mission. Like Washingtonian, they're focused on the region. Like the Washington Post, they're focused on the region. But DCist was really focused on living in DC. And so as a result, I think like they had a pretty big audience that public radio thought they might be able to convert into supporters and donors.
And if this was their conceding that they had not done that?
That's the official line, or one of the official lines, I should say, because I heard many. But, you know, the idea was like, we had bought this thing. It wasn't really working out. We weren't getting like a high number of viewers anymore. But you have to look at it too, in that they had cut so much of the staff through attrition that there was a lot less stuff going up, you know? And as one person I talked to who specializes in this stuff said, he was like, you know, half the story is half the traffic. And for a long time now, when you looked at DCist's homepage, it was the same stories that had been up there for days. You know, they were adding maybe one or two things a week. That is just not how you grow an audience digitally. You have to give them new stuff.
So one of the things about WAMU, I mean, it's a ratings juggernaut, right, on the radio. And granted, the pie of radio listeners may be shrinking, but it's still a ratings juggernaut. And and I think in the kind of framing, there was a lot of like self-awareness that we, you know, some of our stuff is our like civic treasures, right? Like city heroes, like Kojo Namdi. I bet you if they were to do a poll of like who is the most popular Washingtonian, he would win or come very close. Your piece, I mean, had this amazing detail about another sort of civic treasure associated with WAMU, which is Diane Rehm. What happened with that?
Man, Diane Rehm, first of all. So the current manager of the station, Erica Pulley Hayes, she is not known for taking questions, I guess I would say gently. She, you know, avoided periods with the staff where they could ask her about things. She insisted that questions be submitted in writing for all staff meetings. And she, you know, like even after this whole thing happened, she basically hid from any reporter that was trying to get in touch with her.
Did she talk to you?
Eventually, yes. It took about 3 weeks of me emailing every day and just being a general pain in the patoot. But, you know, pester, prod, prevail. That is my motto. But with Diane, there was a meeting right after the layoffs. And Diane asked a question that I think is very relevant, because she said, you're presenting this as a big strategic change, but you laid off all these people who don't have anything to do with, or that kind of like boots on the ground news gathering. You know, one of the things was they said that they were pivoting to audio excellence. Well, they laid off their senior director of technology, the guy who makes sure that the broadcasts sound good. And they laid off reporters who only worked in audio. And so what Diane was asking was, why were you doing that? And suddenly in the middle of asking that, her microphone got cut. And Diane Rehm has been working in some capacity or another at WAMU since 1973. And she knows how to operate the microphone. So Erica told me that she didn't know anything about it, but everyone who was at that meeting said Diane was talking. There was no sound coming out. It really looked like someone had muted her. And Diane did not talk on the record for this story, but I understand she's been very unhappy with a lot of the changes that have been going on. And at the end of this story, I talk about another meeting that they had where Diane asked if, you know, Erica had announced that she was hiring facilitators to talk through people's feelings about the layoffs, but that she was going to sit in on the meetings. And Diane asked, well, what are you going to do if somebody says the problem is you?
Just out and said it. Just bucked up and was like, what if it's you? Dang.
I think she's past the point of really worrying about what her bosses think of her. And Erica said, she paused for a long time and said, I don't know. And then when they got back to their desks, all future staff meetings had been canceled.
Boy, that is a mess.
I would be so terrified to try and mute Diane Rehm. Are you kidding me? My God.
Andrew, do you get the sense that there's going to be more change there at that station?
I have no idea. The kind of communications that they've been doing around it have made it really hard to figure out. Because when I did interview Erica, I am fairly confident that she was reading off of a script most of the time. In fact, there were a couple of points where she gave me answers that had nothing to do with the questions that I'd asked. And, you know, the was this a cost-cutting move? Was this a strategic move? Was it a little bit from column A, a little bit from column B? Everything that American and WAMU has said about this has contradicted other statements that they've made. So when you're looking at the big picture with something like this, you're like, okay, well, are they replacing those positions? And they told Axios that they were going to hire 10 more people. It's been 2 months. There hasn't been a single job up on their website.
It's such a tough thing. You when you are running a thing, and sometimes you have to cut a lot, and it's terrible. And almost no matter what you do, you look like a jerk, and you look, you know, frantic, and so on. But not having sort of a simple, discreet, like, here's where we're going to go, let's, you know, get in line, follow me kind of thing, makes it a lot harder. It sounds to me like there was none of that that you picked up in your reporting.
No, absolutely not. I mean, I think she is a remarkably distant manager. She, you know, I can't tell you how many people told me that she didn't know how to pronounce the names of people who were on the air, which, you know, they took, and I think correctly took, as meaning that she wasn't listening to the radio. When I asked her about what the station was there for, what its mission was, she said, connecting listeners to the world. And it was like, well, okay, sure. That sounds like the kind of a thing that we do in media. But I was like, so what about news? And, you know, she just didn't really have anything to say with it. She, I don't think, really likes news. And I don't think American really loves it either. You know, don't forget, it was DCS that reported on the internal turmoil there when there was a reporter who was credibly accused of being a real creep. And American did everything that they could to not let AMU fire him. And DCS reported on that.
So I don't think there's probably going to be nearly so many facilitating meetings about the people's emotions about the closing of a bunch of Foxtrot locations.
Nice segue.
Hey, I aim to please.
Exactly.
Pivoting to segue excellence.
I know, right?
Julie, you had some feelings, and I think you were maybe not mourning it the way some people were mourning DCist and WAMU.
Fair enough. So for people who were not caught up on this, Foxtrot closed all 33 of its national stores on Tuesday, quite literally in the middle of the lunch rush. And like, you guys have worked downtown. You know what it's like to like try to go out and grab like a salad or a wrap or a sandwich. Imagine going into a store and in the middle of grabbing your like bottle of water, you're getting like shooed out the door and they're locking the door. That is literally what happened on Tuesday to all the DC locations and the other and the 33 national things, which is kind of wild.
Shall we miss Foxtrot?
So at Foxtrot, what I have found, and I don't live near a Foxtrot, but there's one near where my brother lives. There was one in DuPont Circle that, like, if I was, you know, coming back from a night of drinking or whatever, I could go and grab, I don't know, like a bowl of some sort. I find that if you walk in there and you breathe, you spend $50. It's kind of remarkable. I think the goal of it was like interesting. I understand why people want them and need them, especially in a city like DC, where you're constantly kind of on the move and you need to grab stuff and just go. But if you needed to get anything other than like a carton of milk, you were spending like $50, which to me is nuts.
And Andrew, your colleague, Jessica Sidman, my friend, she coined the term gourmet bodegas for this genre of place.
And the funny thing about Washington, DC as a place to live is that there are any number of people, and I think, you know, Foxtrot found a lot of them, who are really happy to go in and be separated from $50 at any point of the day. And, you know, my sole experience was going in and trying to buy a sandwich, not being able to figure out how much the sandwich was, and I didn't want to go up and find out it was $19. So I left the Foxtrot. Now I'll never know if the sandwiches were any good. So that's shame on me. But I think with Foxtrot, their public statement suggests that they had something of a cash crunch. Mm. They had just merged with a similar type of gourmet bodega called Dom's Market.
Based out of Chicago. Yep.
Yeah. And so gosh knows what happened with that. But I think that probably the problem wasn't on the side of what people were willing to spend. Those places looked pretty busy to me.
Yeah, I will say this is a thing that doesn't appear to be going away because there is a lawsuit filed in Illinois because that's where they're headquartered. A manager at one of the stores, Jamil Moore, wants to cover all of the Foxtrot and Dom's employees. Basically, they're trying to file a class action lawsuit, get everybody to rally together. Essentially, what it boils down to is Foxtrot didn't inform employees in the DC area that they were closing the stores after they opened Tuesday, which meant that like you literally had employees shunting people out the doors. The people who bring this lawsuit say that it violates the Warren Act, which is basically a law that requires any company with more than 100 employees to give 60 days notice of a mass layoff. So this is not going away. It will be interesting to see how this winds its way through the Illinois courts and if, you know, the employees are going to band together and say, well, you didn't give us notice. I don't know. What do you guys think about all this?
Well, and it's also empty storefronts in a city that is unfortunately abounds with those. So any idea what's going to happen with those?
I mean, it's obviously going to be Tate's, right?
Yeah, I was going to say, I'm waiting for the Tate across the street from a Tate.
Yeah.
DC just becomes a Tate metropolis.
Were they celebrating a Tate this week?
I don't know. I would need to do that boots on the ground reporting to figure that out for you, Mike.
Enemies vanquished.
Firing London fogs in the air.
Yeah. We can all dream.
All right, Julia, Andrew, awesome to see you guys. Thanks for being here.
Good to see you too, man.
Thanks for having me.
We want to issue a very quick correction for Tuesday's episode. You might remember that we had a segment about funding for DC public schools, and our producer, Ash, mentioned that 200 positions are going to be cut district-wide. We want to clarify that's not all teachers. It's 200 staff positions total. It's confusing. Also confusing is the child care fund to support daycare workers. It's not pre-K and kindergarten teachers. Again, we apologize for the error and know that this budget stuff is really confusing. So confusing, in fact, that we're actually talking to the budget director about it in a future episode. So if you have questions like we do about the city's budget for next year, please tell us.
And that is all for today here on CityCast DC. Our interim executive producers are Julia Caron and Kayla Cote-Stemmerman. Kayla also writes our super informative and fun newsletter, Hey DC. Our interim producer is Ash Durbin, and our hosts are Bridget Todd and me, Michael Schaefer from Politico. Music is by Alex Roldan. If you enjoyed the show, why not tell a friend, rate the show, leave us a review, and subscribe to our morning newsletter. We'll be back Monday morning with more news from around the city. Bye.